Welcome to the Experts in Sport podcast, brought to you by the School of Sport, Exercise and Health Sciences at Loughborough University. This podcast seeks to bring together the worlds of academia and professional practice. If you're interested in the latest research and trends in sport and want to hear from experts from around the world, then subscribe now, because this is the podcast for you. I'm your host, Martin Foster, Applied Sport Management Lead at Loughborough University. Today, we're here with Dr. Richard Blagrove, lecturer in physiology here at Loughborough University, and ultra endurance athlete Tom Evans. We're here to talk about strength training for endurance. In today's podcast, we talk to Tom about the kind of training volume required to be an ultra endurance athlete. We hear Rich and Tom discuss how strength training can be incorporated into an endurance program. We hear how listening to your body and fitting your training around your life is essential for performance. Finally, we hear how running economy can benefit from strength training, including the type of training and exercises that people training for endurance should benefit from. Hi Rich, hi Tom. Thanks for coming in today to talk to us about strength training for endurance. Before we get started, can we just have a brief introduction from you both, starting with Rich?
Yeah, thanks a lot for inviting us on today, Martin. So I'm Rich Blagrove. I'm a lecturer here in physiology and also the programme director for the Masters in Strength and Conditioning. And yeah, I guess we're going to talk a little bit about endurance running today, and specifically about strength training for endurance athletes, which has been my main background really over the last 12 years. Like I've been working with endurance athletes right from recreational level to elite level, including a couple of athletes that have made like Olympic finals, won medals at major international championships. Hoping to dive into some questions with Tom today about his strength training and how he applies principles of strength training.
Brilliant. And yourself, Tom?
And good morning, Martin. Good morning, Rich. Yep, so my name's Tom Evans. I am a recently turned professional ultra-distance trail runner, but do all sorts of distances. I signed up to my first race. It's a race called Marathon de Saab, 250-kilometer race across the desert as part of a drunken bet. that was 2.5 years ago, and I'm now... Yeah, professional trail runner, ranked third in the world, but also, like I said, do other distances, and I've just got back from European Cross Country Championships in Lisbon, where we got a team gold.
Nice. Before we do carry on, and I'm going to let you guys talk a lot, I just want to know, how did you do after the drunken bet?
The drunken bet was a strange thing to bet. I had some friends who did it in 2016. I bet that I could do better after a couple of pints, and 2017 came around, and I ended up being the first non-sub-Saharan African to podium in the race, in 35 years of the race, with very little training as my first ever race. Never done a park run, never done a 10k or anything. It was pretty horrendous, as I'm sure you can imagine, carrying 6 days worth of food with you from day one, running in heats of up to like 45, 46 degrees. But yeah, so I guess I must have got the bug from there, and I now look forward to these things, which is slightly bizarre.
That's pretty amazing. I think me and Rich have done a podcast previously, and we've talked about needing to do one on genetics. We certainly do need to do that in the future, which I think we will. But for now, we're going to talk about strength training for endurance athletes. I'm going to take a seat back and let Rich, as an expert researcher, speak to Tom as an elite athlete, and we're going to find out a lot more about strength training for endurance. I might come in with a few questions here and there, but mainly I'll leave it to you guys. So over to you guys.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks a lot, Martin. You mentioned before that you've just come back from the European Cross Country Championships in Lisbon. Like, it was a really exceptional performance to make the team. I think unexpected to some extent that an ultra marathon runner kind of steps in to the trial event at Liverpool with the best 5k, 10k runners in the country, and you were up there mixing it with those guys. I think you finished, was it fifth overall?
Fifth overall.
Yeah, and then you went on to finish, was it 44th at the European Championships, and win the team gold medal, which was a fantastic achievement. Like, how did you find the experience out there? Was there anything that you kind of learnt about the preparation for those races that will help you?
Yeah, definitely. So I think taking a step backwards, I got injured at the end of July. I had a knee problem, wasn't entirely sure what it was, had a couple of scans, still not fully diagnosed. I was supposed to be racing the mountain running world championships, but just couldn't get enough volume at the right intensity to be able to perform at a standard that I would have been happy with. So we sort of took it all the way back to basics and sort of actually really focused on strength and conditioning. Especially sort of knee stability, hip stability, making sure everything's lining up, that would then in process help my biomechanics. And we were able to get the quality of training in, be able to get that intensity, but not, I wasn't, I'd say, brave enough, or there, for me, there was no point in risking it at this early stage in my career. So actually we thought, right, let's focus on a bit shorter distances, like up to 10, 12K perhaps, which I'm sure for some people seems like a long way, but I think as a visor, it's all relative. And so entered Milton Keynes cross country, that went really well, finished third there, and sort of thought, right, at that point entered Liverpool. And I guess the goal from the build up was qualifying. Liverpool itself is a race that's going to suit me because
it's muddy generally.
It's muddy, it's a little bit slower. So actually, me maybe being able to run my 10k PB is like 29:45. I think I could probably run sub 29 now.
Yeah.
Considering the guys who sort of I've been running with. And so, yeah, then to go to Liverpool, and it was Liverpool went really well, and then to qualify for Lisbon to that was incredible, and that was the goal from this build up. So goal achieved. To then go out to Lisbon, which, yeah, like you say, you are against the best 5-10K runners in Europe. And it was just super fast. It was relentless. There was no give up. Yes, it was quite a hilly course, but they were all short hills. There was no need to grind. It was more anaerobic than aerobic on the hills. And I thought, actually, when I saw the course, I thought, oh, it's a nice hilly course, it should really suit me. But the longest climb was 40 seconds, which actually isn't, for me, it wasn't that beneficial. And yes, there were some good downhill bits where I like to think my downhill running is good, but I was just so tired from the uphills. And yeah, to finish 44th, like, is first Europeans, like, great. Obviously, I would have liked to have done better, but what does my best look like? Because I didn't really set a goal for it, because the goal was to qualify. It was difficult.
So anything's a bonus from there.
Yeah, precisely. Yeah. So for me, it was being part of the team and trying to facilitate and trying to help the team do as well as possible. And to walk away with the team gold, is incredible. That doesn't happen every day. And to be on paper, a 100K, 100-mile runner, and to now have sort of hung up in my living room at home.
On your CV.
a European gold medal is incredible. And I don't think there are many athletes who have done that. And I know there was one other long distance athlete who's a ski mountaineer from Norway who was racing, and we finished, I think, five places within each other. Really interesting to be able to show that actually top end endurance, it is able to translate. It's not a progression from 800 metres to 1500 metres to 3k indoors to 5k to 10k. Actually, I've skipped all of that and sort of come in at the long distances, and now I'm coming back down. And it's sort of nice to show people that actually you don't have to have that sort of pedigree background in order to compete for GB places.
Yeah, absolutely. So I think you mentioned before we came on air that you've got a couple of much, much longer races in the next calendar year. Like, how will your training kind of change from the preparation that you had before Liverpool and Lisbon into those long events? Is it just a case of doing a longer run each week, or does your overall volume increase quite considerably?
So my overall volume does increase, and like typically if I'm training for cross country and or shorter races, less than 10 miles, or maybe even up to half marathon, it will be maximum of 100 miles a week with a session on Tuesday, Thursday, and then a fast tempo on Saturday, or combined into my long run on Sunday. Whereas when I pick up to the longer distances, so I've got a 100K race in February in New Zealand, I will either do, I'll drop one session, but the Thursday session I'll drop, and I'll either do a long run instead of that on Thursday, that will go up to 2/3 of the distance or time that I'm going to run. So this 100k race, so maybe I'll do a 60k long run that will take in and around 4 hours.
Wow.
In the Peak District.
Yeah.
And I'll still keep a marathon pace tempo in, or half marathon pace tempo in, and I will still do a session on Tuesday, so in order to increase my lactate turn point or lactate threshold and my VO2 max, and actually get fast. And that session might look like 4 by 8 minutes at 10k pace, or 8 by 1k with hill reps after 3 and 7.
Yeah.
And so it's still typical training, and the volume won't go crazy. So it might get up to 135 miles in this block, which
sounds pretty crazy to me.
Which may seem like a lot, but that's if you compare that to a proper elite marathon. If you compare that to Mo Farah, his training at peak volume when he's on training camp in Ethiopia may go up to,
will be similar to that,
will be very similar to that. And actually you're comparing a just over 2 hour race to a 7 hour race, so actually the volume, it seems high, but it's not that high, because there's still,
relatively speaking,
quite a lot of, there still is a lot of quality in the mix of
quantity. Yeah, and certainly with the marathon runners that I've worked with in the past, including a couple that have competed at Olympic Games, have been running similar sorts of volumes. So I guess, the challenge for me as the strength and conditioning coach is how to fit like non-running based conditioning and weights room work into that program. So how do you manage to go about that? Like you said, you placed quite a big priority on it off the back of this knee injury that you had building into the cross country season. But how do you kind of integrate strength and conditioning type work into your program?
I think the strength and conditioning is really important, but it is definitely an accessory to the running. I think for me, when the moment that, and there'll be different parts of, in different phases of the season, different elements of the periodization throughout the year and throughout training blocks, strength and conditioning will play a bigger part. But when I sort of go into peak volume of running, the strength and conditioning can actually sometimes be really hard to balance, because the intensity is there with the running, as is the volume, and trying to balance that strength and conditioning, which I know, and it is an essential part of the week. And I'll do 2 strength and conditioning sessions every week, except for race week, where I'll just do 1 and a little bit less volume as well. And it's just balancing, right, do I do it? Do I really want to do a strength and conditioning session the day before a workout? No. Do I want to do it the day after a long run? Well, actually, if it's more of a conditioning session, if I do a one sort of more of a heavyweight power session on a beginning of the week and then more conditioning at the end of the week, actually, can I do that conditioning, strength and conditioning session after a running workout or a running long run? Yes, I can. And actually, is that going to be event beneficial? Yes, if I've recovered as well as I possibly could in between the two sessions. And is that specific to what I am training for? Yes, because I need to train at a high volume. And if I've done a 4 hour run in the morning, actually training volume adds up, training stress tolerance does add up. And if I've done 4 hours in the morning and then an hour and a half in the gym in the afternoon, yes, there'll be times where I'm sat down hating my life in the gym. And the rest of the time. But actually, that's then a really big day. That's a 5.5 hour volume day, because your body doesn't differentiate between different types of stress that's being applied on it. And if you can balance that, and especially going into the winter, it definitely is a balancing act of being outside for 4 hours is a long time. If it's raining, if it's cold, you are so much more, your immune system's taking a massive battering. You're then going into a busy gym that you don't want to be that guy sort of sat down sort of putting hand sanitizer on in between every rep and every set, but
washing the bar
and washing everything. But that's something that you need to consider, because your immune system's down. You're then going into a slightly crowded place where hygiene is good, but it's not perfect, as it isn't anywhere. And it's just it's being really aware of those things. And actually, I've done a 4 hour run this morning. I was supposed to go to the gym this afternoon, but it was snowing in the Peak District. Is it worth it? And I think the thing that I've really learned as an ultra endurance athlete is the times where your body is saying, I should do this or I shouldn't do this. And it's differentiating that between, right, I'm just tired now, or I'm being a bit lazy, or yeah. I should do it, or it's a, actually, is it worth doing it? Like, tomorrow's a new day.
Yeah.
Is it worth, right, can I change? It's Tuesday now. Can I change my program ever so slightly that it's all going to fit in? And I think that's the beauty of being an endurance athlete, where you're not... I'm lucky enough to be able to choose all of my races. I don't have... Yeah, my coach. Yes, I have a coach. She's based in Sussex, and when I'm in Sussex, I'll train with her in the AB training group. And but it's a right. This the session's going to happen here and here, but around that, I fit things in, and suddenly, I was in the military for 8 years before, and that's given me such a great way of being able to plan my day. And there's no one telling me, "Oh, you need to go out and do 5 hours of running." Like, that's in my program, and it's right. Do I do that on Monday or Wednesday? Like, how does that work with the rest of my life? Because you've got to maintain in a sport where it's so fully immersive and you have to fully buy into it, you still need an element of balance. Like, I moved house this week. How am I gonna
take a bit out of you, for sure.
How am I gonna,
that's a strength training session in its own right, moving boxes,
boxes and beds upstairs and put things together. Like, is it, do I reduce my training volume for a couple of days so I can sleep on a bed that I've made? Yes, well, that's a no-brainer. In the grand scheme of things, that's a, if you were so strict on following a training program and you're not listening to your body and you've got a little bit of a cold, but then you're going to bed at midnight, 1 a.m. because you've been emptying boxes, it just doesn't make sense. And I think that's a, and that sort of definitely plays in with strength and conditioning. And I do my strength and conditioning sessions are they're really focused on and really specific on the race that I'm training for. So if there's a lot of uphill in a race, then I'll work a lot on my posterior chain sort of exercises, like Romanian deadlift or single leg deadlift, or step ups and box jumps, things to just really get sort of glutes and hamstrings firing. So actually, in a, if you're relating that into a race environment or into a training environment, it's those long hills that are becoming a bit of a drag, but then there's a step or there's a bit of a ledge or a rock that you've got to do a big step up, like the equivalent of you're walking upstairs and you decide, actually, I'm now going to take two steps instead of one step. And it's being able to contract the maximum amount of muscle fibers and create the least amount of damage, because this isn't a 1 hour race or a 2 hour race. Sometimes these races will last 20 hours. And in order to reduce the muscle damage at the beginning of the race, so you can, yeah, you can last for longer, because actually you don't know what the effect is going to be 15, 18, 20 hours down the line.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, and just going back to what you were talking about in terms of positioning the strength and conditioning of the week, it's very much how I've gone about doing it before. And I think really the main message is it's context specific, it's individual specific. And if we look at the kind of research on that in terms of where we place it around running sessions, the majority says we need about six hours or so of recovery, which for a recreational athlete isn't always that possible. Like, you sometimes have to combine sessions or do one after the other. But certainly with the elite guys that I've worked with, like, we do similar to you. We try and place the heavier strength and conditioning sessions on the same day as actually some of the harder sessions in the week. And I often term that a kind of polarized type design, where if they do a hard track interval session or a hard tempo run in the morning on a Tuesday or a Thursday, they have 6 hours recovery, and then they do a heavy strength training session in the gym, which means the day after is a complete recovery day. So they just go out and run easy for 40, 50, 60 minutes maybe. So organising the week in that sort of way seems to be a bit more optimal than doing strength and conditioning on an easy day, when essentially then you've got something hard on most days of the week.
No, and I completely agree with that. And that's the, for me, that was the real benefit of being able to become a full-time athlete. So you've got that time in that day in order to recover. And recovery isn't, sadly, sort of being sat behind a desk working. It's still stress going in then. So as an elite runner, that's great. But as a, like you said, as a recreational runner, that may not be possible. And I'm sure a lot of the people listening are thinking, like, right, how can I get, I want to do an ultra marathon, or I want to do a marathon. And how do I, I've heard strength and conditioning is important. How do I combine that? Well, yes, the best way research shows us to do it like this. However, there are lots of other ways of doing it. It's completely person specific. Yeah. Do I advise doing a really hard tempo run in the morning, all the intervals on the track in the morning, going to work all day, and then going to the gym to do a really heavy session at 8 in the evening? No, I probably wouldn't advise that. But that may work for you, that may work for your surroundings, and it's just thinking like, right, where can I improve, where can I make these gains? And it is so individual specific.
Yeah. I mean, one of the other strategies, so again, speaking about recreational runners that I've only proposed in a research paper, there's not much research on it, is rather than doing strength and conditioning sessions, thinking about strength and conditioning as training units and trying to microdose different types of strength and conditioning activity throughout the training week. So you almost end up doing something every single day. So for example, if you're doing a hard session, you might do a small amount of plyometrics before you then go and do the hard session, incorporate it into your warm-up. You might get back from an easy run and do some type of resistance training at home. Or you might do some sort of trunk training, calf conditioning type training unit after another run in the week. So rather than trying to dedicate an hour, 75 minutes to a strength and conditioning session, which takes up quite a lot of time, and it's just more training added to the overall volume, you've kind of got it split up or divided and spread throughout the training week, which is quite often a little bit easier to manage if you've got work constraints and family social constraints that are taking up a lot of time. Just moving on to, so you already mentioned a bit about some of the exercises that you do. I mean, just to kind of put into context some of what you've already spoken about and some appropriate ways to approach strength and conditioning. So as part of my PhD, we published a systematic review which looked at all of the research studies that have been published around strength training for distance runners. I think it was about 50 or so. It's quite a lot. But we put 26 of those papers into this. Yeah, Martin's got it just here. We put 26 of those papers into this review, but I mean, generally across the literature, we tend to see improvements in a physiological parameter called running economy as a result of doing 2 to 3 months of strength training. So running economy is essentially how much oxygen, or I guess more specifically, how much energy you're using at a submaximal intensity, which for endurance running has obviously got relevance, because if we can use less energy or less oxygen, move a bit more efficiently, then we're saving energy and oxygen for later on in the event, and we should be able to run at a faster speed for the same level of energy. Most of the research within those studies has tended to use heavy resistance training or explosive training and sometimes plyometric training as well. So can you perhaps, would you be able to elaborate on like what types of exercise you use? Like, I think you mentioned some posterior chain exercises like Romanian deadlifts, probably squats, I imagine. Yeah. But what other types of exercise do you use which fall kind of within those training categories?
Yeah, so I found, and for me, running economy, the reason why I will do strength and conditioning, yes, some research says it helps with injury prevention, but who knows, you could still twist your ankle.
Jury's out, still out there on that one.
It's not going to stop every injury. Yes, it may help. It may be 1%, 2%, and that's great. But for me, it's all about running economy. Yeah. And I want to make, for running, I want to make things as easy as possible. I want my body to, if 6-minute miling is easy, that's great. Well, what if it's 6-minute miling this week? How about in 4 months' time? Can I get 5:55?
Easy.
Because actually those 5 seconds a mile, when you're running 100 miles, is a
absolutely
huge difference. So yeah, and I will... So yeah, in order to boost running economy, like we spoke about earlier, the heavier session I'll do at the beginning of the week, probably on the same day as a harder session. Yeah, that is typically a rep range, maybe 3 to 5 reps in 4 to 6 sets, sort of depending on how I'm feeling and depending on the exercises. Normally things are supersetted, so I might do sort of heavy squats with eccentric calf conditioning, or just some calf holds. Or I might do, if I'm sort of doing a bit of a hip complex, sort of with a single leg glute bridge, weighted, may just be sort of really explosive movement followed by a bit of a hold or another explosive movement.
Yep.
I'll sort of do a session like that, typically on a Tuesday evening, sort of after I've done a hard session in the morning. And then Thursday, which is normally after a bit of a longer run, will be a more of a sort of general conditioning session where it might be exercises more with sort of a larger rep range. And people sort of say, oh, you're an endurance athlete, you should be doing, like, how many reps do you do, thinking you need to
do... Yeah, that's a good point. Yeah.
Thinking you need to do loads. Well, no, let's say you're a 400-meter runner, for example, on a track, and you're taking a 2-meter stride for each... Yeah, you're taking a 2-meter stride each stride. So, hopefully my math is going to be right here, but you're going to take 200 strides... going around the track. So that's the equivalent of doing 200 reps or 100 reps on each leg for a 400 meter runner. So using that logic, each set for a 400 meter runner would be 100. If you're doing single leg calf raises, you'd do 100 on each leg for each set. Imagine doing for a 100 mile runner. It just wouldn't work. So actually, you think, like, right, why am I doing this? Like, if I lift heavier, I am using the maximum... what I am trying to do when I'm in the gym is use maximum muscle fibers, muscle fiber recruitment to be as high as possible. So everything gets trained, but also I think your body then learns how to use the muscle fibers and also which energy system it's going to use to do that. There will be times in a race where you need to put an anaerobic effort in. It might be a really hard step up, or it might be you're jumping across a stream. You've got to have that in your body, and if you haven't trained it, you're not really going to be able to access it. And it's the same with going sort of slightly diversing onto energy systems. I want to be as efficient as possible, use as much oxygen as I can, because I want to be fully aerobic for as long as I possibly can. Because as soon as my body starts producing lactic acid, and as soon as I go sort of past my lactate turn point, that's game over.
Yeah.
Because that could happen.
There's no going back.
That could happen in the first 5 minutes of a race.
Yeah.
You do the first mile too quick. Right. That may catch up in 2 hours, 3 hours. It may catch up in 10 hours.
Yeah.
It's going to catch up at some point.
Yeah.
Then actually, if I can do this strength conditioning work, which... on the outside may not... I was like, oh, why is... He's a 100-mile runner. Why is he doing...
Three reps of
squats.
Yeah.
And then when you explain it and break it down, you're like, no, that makes perfect sense.
I'm glad you used that example as well, because, I mean, that's a very, very similar example to ones that I often use when I'm talking to runners and their coaches. And I mean, in strength and conditioning, we'd kind of call it the specificity trap a little bit. That if you just look at the biomechanics and the physiology of the sport and you try and simulate it, you actually just end up back at running. Like you say, okay, we need to do everything on one leg, we need to do it through short range, we need to do it through repetition ranges and energy systems that are similar, and you just end up back at something that resembles running. And if you're already doing 100, 120 miles a week, like, what's the point of doing that? And so a better way to think about these kind of non-specific or non-running based activities is trying to train the adaptation that we're looking to get. So Tom alluded to a couple of them there, like, we're trying to improve the recruitment of muscle fibers, and if we can change the maximal recruitment of muscle fibers, we know at a submaximal level, like, you're essentially using a lower relative amount of the total muscle fibers you could recruit. And if we get changes, like, we tend to see changes in connective tissue and tendon stiffness off the back of resistance training and plyometric training as well. And so if we get changes in that, like, it's likely we're going to store and return elastic energy a bit more effectively. So that probably also contributes to this change that we see in running economy. Essentially, you're just using your muscles less to do the same work. You're using the free energy that we get from tendons. And we also see some changes in speed as well. So you mentioned, like, anaerobic energy systems, which, you obviously don't use very much at sort of 5K and above, and certainly not ultra distance running. But if we have to go up a steep hill, or we've got to do a sprint finish, or there's a surge in a 5K, 10K track race, then we need to be able to cope with that. And so if we can access an anaerobic energy system and come back and retain aerobic type metabolism, then that's going to help our overall performance as well.
And looking at that, looking at the speed, even if it's the small speed of your ground contact time, when you're, yes, running 100 metres obviously is incredibly important, 400 metres very important, but actually when you go up to 100 miles or 100 kilometres, that ground contact time all adds up. When you've, yes, you're going to need to put your foot on the floor, but actually when you're on, when your foot's hitting the ground, it's braking. You want to brake for as short a time as possible. And if you can reduce your ground contact time when you're right, when, yeah, in any running, then that is only going to be beneficial to you. The less time spent braking is better. If you're imagining the car, yeah, if you just sort of, you don't want to brake some from way out from a roundabout and sort of go into a turn. And it is this, yeah, it's the same with, if you imagine running down a slalom ski slope, you're sort of going left, right, as of lots of switchbacks, hairpin turns. Actually having that strength and that control to be able to flow through it rather than braking, stopping, turning, keeping on going, stopping. All you're trying to do is make life as easy for yourself as possible. And
yeah,
by being quick and being light on your feet over 100 miles, it makes such a huge difference.
Yeah, absolutely. And sort of bringing it back to finish off, I guess, to ultra distance running, like, we know fairly well that over 5K, 10K, half marathon, that running economy, VO2 max, which is the maximum amount of oxygen that we can use, and lactate threshold are sort of the most important physiological determinants. But when we get up to sort of 50K, 80K, and then over 100K, like, the science just kind of isn't there. Like, they're very, very difficult events to research, so we don't really know what physiological determinants and attributes are that important. But certainly up to about 80K, like, it seems that running economy, the speed that we can elicit at VO2 max, which are heavily influenced by strength training, are really important determinants.
Yeah, I think for me, and I get submaximal testing done. Actually, this afternoon, I'm sort of going to the lab in Loughborough to do submaximal and maximal, because I think it is really important. You want to run as quickly as you... I want to be able to run as quickly as I can without producing lactic acid.
Mm.
And as quickly... And depending on what that is... Yeah, if it's 6 minute miles, great. If it's 7 minute miles, great. But as if you know what it is, you're then not going to go over it. And yes, pace is only one element of it. What if you start going up a hill? What if you start going down a hill? What if it's hot? What if it's cold? It sort of all combines into feel and into heart rate as well. So that's another podcast for another day.
Yeah.
And yeah, economy is, in my economy tests always last way longer than they should, and I'll sort of bring in previous data and they'll say, yeah, oh, I think they've probably done this wrong. But my submaximal test ended up being sort of an hour 15 minutes. And
yeah,
they're like, well, are you sure you want to do your maximal now? Because yeah, they just weren't expecting it. Like, a little bit of lactic acid and it just stays low, and it just stays low, and it just, yeah, stays low for a long time. And it's like, that's, yes, probably is slightly genetic, but from doing strength and conditioning is only going to improve.
Yeah, give it a little nudge, yeah. And what I was going to say, mention before, is like over 100 kilometres, like, what we do know from the science is, like, one major limiting factor is muscle damage that you referred to before. So, like, it probably plays a little bit of a role in sort of marathon distances, but when you get to that sort of duration of running, like, the extent of muscle damage that you've got is a huge limiting factor for performance. So there has been some speculation in the scientific literature that some things like eccentric dominant training, where your muscles lengthening under tension and doing plyometrics, like, might offset the amount of muscle damage you get. So for those types of distances where we're up at sort of 100 kilometers plus, like, doing, yeah, eccentric dominant types of training like those should take priority. And, like, I don't know if you use any of those sorts of training.
Yeah, and certainly for a race that's got lots of downhill running, will be really specific on sort of eccentric quad loading and sort of knee stability, because that's where running downhill is where the major damage, yeah, is caused. Like, I'll do recovery runs on a treadmill, and it might be physiologically or cardiovascularly even not a recovery run, because heart rate will probably get quite high, but actually the amount of tension, the amount of pressure going onto the legs running uphill isn't that much, which is brilliant, and it's a great recovery tool. And I've got a stupid treadmill at home that goes to 40%, which is amazing, because actually muscle damage, not very much, but you then put it on, the treadmill also goes to a 6% decline. you do a hard session on that and you know about it
the next day. Yeah, sure.
And it's right, doing a 10 kilometer downhill, what benefit am I getting from that? It's benefit versus muscle damage. Can I achieve a similar benefit from doing some eccentric loading in the gym? Yes. Is the muscle damage going to be as bad? No. But if I still achieve what I want to achieve, yes. Well, that then makes complete sense to do it. Mm. Because do I want to run? Like, it's all about the process.
Mm.
And that within the process is the consistency. And I'm not talking consistency from, yes, it is from session to session, week on week, month on month, but it's also year on year. Like, I will.
Absolutely. Yeah.
In an ideal world, I would love to be able to target the marathon at Paris.
Mm.
And if I'm the most consistent runner from now till then, I don't see why I can't race a 100 mile race 4 months before.
Yeah.
And then race a selection event if there is one, and then go into Paris, and I may even be on the start line of a marathon early next year.
Hope so. Good to see you doing a marathon.
Interesting to see what happens. And
yeah. Yeah, it's a good point to finish on that, like, it's often referred to as the cardinal rule of training, that you've just got to be consistent. And I think for well-trained and elite runners, it sort of sounds quite obvious that you just need to train consistently over years and years. And, like, those types of athletes are quite motivated. But in order to train consistently, you've got to avoid injury, illness, overtraining. And so if part of avoiding injury is doing strength and conditioning, then, like, it's something that a lot of people should be including in their training.
I think this talk has been amazing, because I've sat here and not had to say a word, and you two have spoken, covered everything we wanted to cover. So I think it's been absolutely brilliant. Can we just, to finish, Tom, would you just want to give us a recommendation for an endurance runner, what you would say, kind of training volume, load, you know, endurance, whatever day, strength, and then can you just add to it what the research might say to that? You know, it might conflict, it might not, but it'd be interesting to see both sides. It sounds like you're both on the same page, so that's pretty cool.
Yep.
So Tom, what would you advise an endurance runner? What should they do in a week, just an average endurance run?
So I'd take, if I took my I'd take my Saturday. So wake up Saturday, I tend to use as like a race replication day, so it'll be sort of a tempo run. So get up, breakfast 2-3 hours before, tempo run will be anything up to 20 miles at marathon pace, and yeah, after that sort of come back, chill out for a little bit, and then after that it's time to go to the gym. So probably, yes, in an ideal world 6 hours, but sometimes that may not happen. You may have things to do, dogs to walk, all of these things, life that gets in the way. And then yeah, it will be my sort of more conditioning session, so slightly higher rep range, slightly lower sets, so exercises such as a reverse lunge with a little bit of an eccentric load, kettlebell swings, pull-ups, press-ups, calf raises. So the exercises I can do a little bit more volume on without achieving a huge amount of muscle damage. And then after that, sort of probably an easy shake-up run afterwards, so just to prime myself for my Sunday long run. So it would be a pretty typical Saturday with lots of food in between.
And what would you advise, Rich? So a training week, let's say, what would you advise there?
I think from an endurance perspective, like, a lot of the research that's been done over the last 10 years is kind of showing that, like, a polarized model seems to work quite well with an 80-20 split. So what I mean by that is 80% of your total running mileage or volume for within a week should be at a fairly easy pace, like kind of recovery run type intensity. And that should be performed quite strictly. So probably somewhere around 60% max heart rate. Like, it will feel like a jog for most people, but it's quite important that you take those sessions as easy recovery sessions. And then the other 20% is left for harder interval training type sessions and maybe tempo type intensity. And I think, as Tom's describing, as this kind of race replication type performance. But what it means is within that 20%, you can hit those sessions quite hard, and probably once a week, like, make sure you're laying on your back fully exhausted and you've gone as hard as you possibly can. And it kind of leaves the sort of middle ground untouched, if you like, a kind of moderate type intensity. And I think the mistake a lot of people make is they drift a lot of their easy recovery type runs into that middle type intensity. So a lot of their volume during the training week ends up being a little bit too hard, and they don't recover well enough from the harder sessions. So I think what Tom's describing there is really appropriate, that he has long, easy recovery runs, which are just building up an aerobic base, and then his two or three harder sessions each week where he's trying to simulate race intensities and doing things a little bit harder.
I think a way that we describe it is you do your easy runs easy so you can do your hard runs hard.
Yeah.
And like, what does a hard run look like? Like, people will say, like, I know it's so individual, but like, on an easy run, like, I wear a heart rate monitor for everything. And I don't just use heart rate, I don't just use pace, I don't just use feel. I will combine those three bits of data on every run, and it midway through a training block you will learn, right, I know for my easy runs my heart rate is not going to go above 135 beats a minute. What does that look like? Pace on flat, that might be 4 minutes per k, that might be 6:15 minute miling. But actually, on a day that I may have done a track session in the evening, or I might be really tired, and that
ends up being a bit slower.
Your immune system's going down, and actually that pace drops back, but actually you're getting the same benefit, because I then know, if consistency is the key, that if I am doing my easy runs easy, and I'd much rather do my easy run too easy than my easy run a little bit too hard, because that's then going to enable me to recover. So then 2 days down the line, I can do my hard session fully recovered and get the maximum benefit from it, making it as specific as possible, and hopefully in the process not getting injured, because your training stress level is too high.
I think it was the reason I got injured a lot when I was a runner. Like, I was more of a middle distance runner, but had quite a few injuries, probably because I did my easy runs too hard. My interval sessions were always pretty good, and I'd keep up with guys that were competing at international level, but I'd generally do my recovery runs a bit too hard. And I think over time, like, it causes injury. And so it's something that you need to avoid, and just be a little bit stricter with the way that you're operating during intentional recovery runs.
I think that's the thing, though, is everybody thinks, well, if I just go a little bit harder,
exactly,
a little bit better. Yeah. But you're saying that in that hard session is where you need to go harder, and that's where you'll get better. Therefore, go easier on the easy session so you can go hard again.
And it almost sounds counterintuitive, go slower in order to go faster.
Mm.
But in people, and it does take a lot of confidence to do it, like, oh, I'm running so much slower than I used to. But actually, those easy runs, I spent, and this is for another podcast, I spent 2 months in Ethiopia, and I was running with guys who are 206, 207 marathoners. My easy run was quicker than theirs. That makes zero sense. And so at that point, I then reevaluated, like, why am I, what is the purpose of this? Well, I want to feel better when I get back in than I do when I left. And if you honestly look at yourself in the mirror and be like, right, do I feel better now? But 9 times out of 10, probably like, no, that was actually a little bit hard, and it should be, my heart rate went up a bit, I ran a little bit fast to get across the traffic lights. And that's not the purpose. Every run should serve a purpose. And when you are in that middle ground, people love to talk about junk mileage. I see that sort of middle ground somewhere between easy and hard. Unless you're doing something specifically sort of at race pace, then I see that is where junk miles may pick up. Like, I might do my first run after a hard session might be, the first mile might take 12 minutes. I'm fortunate enough to
have, I could keep up with that, just
fortunate enough to have enough time to do that in the day. But if you're sort of worried, like, oh, I've got to go to work at 7:30, that means I've got to get up at 6:30 in order to run, because I have to run 6 miles this morning, you know you're going to have to run at a certain pace. Like, what if you don't feel good that day? Like, are you going to rush it? Are you going to say, oh, I have an extra 10 minutes in bed, but then have to run 8 minutes quicker? So, yeah, it does take a lot of confidence, but it does.
And that's a big thing for the general population. Everyone nowadays, it's all kind of interval training, cram your session in, go as hard as you can every single time. And then, just as previously, progress stops and you're not progressing anymore. Even in an interval session, you know, I've coached in quite a lot of places, even in interval sessions, where it's the rest time, people are going, can I do a plank? Can I do this? Can I do that? No, because it's going to absolutely kill you when you do that interval. So yeah. Even in that short space,
on your next set, you're
trying to do too much.
Yeah.
But then also not necessarily just then. You might only start feeling it a month down the line.
Yeah, by then, the cumulative fatigue.
Yeah, it comes back to this point of consistency that, like most people could be consistent. You'll see in January after Christmas when everyone goes and joins the gym, like people will be consistent through January. But when it gets to February, people, because of motivation and maybe injuries and so on, like people will start dropping out. And the same happens at an elite level, that like, most people can be consistent for a few weeks, a few months. But as Tom says, like it takes consistency year on year, not month on month, in order to reach your goals and reach your potential.
Guys, I think that's probably plenty for us to have recorded there. I knew we could start going on and on different things and stuff, but everything you've covered has been absolutely brilliant. And now that you're on campus, Tom, we may certainly harass you again to come and do a podcast with us, because I think there's a lot of other topics we could cover. But thanks to both of you for coming along today.
No, thank you very much.
Thanks, Martin, and thanks, Tom.
No, thanks very much.
Thanks for listening to the Loughborough Sportcast. If you want to get in touch and let us know any subject areas or experts that you'd be keen to listen to, then contact me, Martin Foster, on m.foster@alborough.ac.uk or tweet me at martinfoster82. Bye for now. We'll see you next time.